received a major public boost from Kramer, then a new face at CNBC, when he declared on television that all Lehman needed to do was buy back its own shares to halt the downward spiral and squeeze the shorts. The following morning, Fuld, who had never met Kramer, called him at his office and told him, "I bid $31 for 1 million shares of Lehman." Shares of the company steadied soon afterward. If Wall Street had indeed been taking on some aspects of a Shakespearean tragedy, Kramer would likely serve as the comic relief. Voluble and wild-eyed, he spoke in his TV appearances so quickly that it often seemed as if his head might explode from the sheer effort of communicating his ideas. But for all his Carnival Barker antics, people on Wall Street knew Kramer was no fool. He had managed a hedge fund and founded TheStreet.com, an early and influential investing website, and had a keen understanding of how the market worked. Fuld and Kramer had come to respect each other as no-nonsense street fighters, despite their pronounced differences in character. Kramer, a media star, was solidly Harvard, had once worked at Goldman, and counted as one of his best friends Elliot Spitzer, the bane of Wall Street. Fuld, for his part, tended to despise Ivy Leaguers, liked to think of himself as the anti-Goldman, and had never been much of a communicator. Still, he appreciated the fact that Kramer had always been an honest broker, willing to speak his mind, however unpopular his opinions might be. After one of Lehman's waitstaff had taken food orders for the group, Fuld walked an attentive Kramer through his talking points. Lehman, Fuld said, was working hard to reduce the firm's leverage and restore confidence among investors. Though they had raised $4 billion in new capital in the first quarter, Fuld was convinced that a cabal of shorts was preventing the stock price from being properly reflected. The franchise was undervalued. Kramer nodded his head energetically. "Look," he said, "I think there is definitely a problem with the shorts. They're leaning all over you." Fuld was gratified to see that he had a receptive audience. As he was well aware, his short seller predicament touched on an obscure issue near and dear to Kramer, the uptick rule, regulation that had been introduced by the Securities and Exchange Commission in 1938 to prevent investors from continually shorting a stock that was falling. In other words, before a stock could be shorted, the price had to rise, indicating that there were active buyers for it in the market. Theoretically, the rule would prevent stocks from spiraling straight downward, with short sellers jumping on for the ride. But in 2007, the commission had abolished the rule, and to critics like Kramer, its decision had been influenced by free market ideologues, who were eager to remove even the most benign speed bumps from the system. Ever since, Kramer had been warning anyone who'd listen that without this check, hedge funds were free to blitzkrieg good companies and drive down their stock. But until the current crisis, few had been willing to listen to his admonitions. Because their hedge fund clients wanted the rule eliminated, Wall Street firms were happy to accede, right up until the time that they themselves became the target of short sellers and had to run for cover. "You can be a great ally to me on this uptick rule crusade," Kramer said. Fuld contemplated his guest's enthusiasm as he silently weighed the advantages and disadvantages of lending his firm's name to the cable news star's crusade. Kramer was probably right about the rule's removal hurting Lehman, but Fuld also knew that his firm's own arbitrage desk had hedge fund clients who were selling short, and they made the firm a great deal of money. He certainly didn't want to alienate them, and at the same time, he recognized that there was a legitimate debate about the issue. And however protective the restrictions may have been intended to be, Fuld knew perfectly well that investors could get around them by using options and derivatives. Donini, skeptical that the uptick rule was Lehman's biggest problem, interjected on behalf of Fuld. "What are you trying to accomplish, Jim?" he asked. "The shorts are destroying great companies," Kramer replied. "They destroyed Bear Stearns, and they're trying to destroy Lehman," he said, perhaps trying to play to Fuld's ego. "I want to stop that." "If you're trying to accomplish that," Donini replied, "and you believe that shorts are causing the problem, then I don't believe the uptick rule is the way to do it." Donini explained to Kramer that he felt the real problem in the marketplace was naked shorting. Normally, when investors sell shares short, the investor first borrows the shares from a broker, sells them, and then hopes they drop in value so the investor can buy them at a lower price, replace the borrowed shares, and pocket the difference as a profit. But in naked shorting, which is illegal, the investor never borrows the underlying shares, potentially allowing them to manipulate the market. Kramer was intrigued, but also visibly taken aback by Donini's answer. He had been invited to the meeting, had offered to help, and now his offer was being rejected. He tried changing the subject back to Lehman's troubles. "Well, why don't you give me ammo so that I can tell a positive story?" he suggested. Sensing the tension rising in the room, Callan interjected, speaking up for the first time. "We just bought this unbelievable portfolio from Peloton, and it's immediately accretive," she said, cheerfully offering what she considered a bit of good news. But Kramer could barely conceal a frown, for he knew a good deal about Peloton. Based in London, the hedge fund had been started by Ron Beller, a former Goldman executive whose wife was a policy advisor to Prime Minister Gordon Brown. It had once been among the top-performing hedge funds in the world, but had faltered, selling its assets in a virtual fire sale. "Geez," Kramer answered with as much tact as he could muster. "I'm surprised to hear it's any good, given the fact that they were levered 30-1 with what I hear is a lot of bad stuff." "No," Fuld said enthusiastically. "We got this for a song." Kramer did not look convinced. "One of the things I'm really unclear about is that, if you talk to Goldman, Goldman's radically trying to deleverage. And what you're saying is, I'm gonna deleverage, but you actually are increasing your leverage." Fuld, who didn't appreciate the tone of the observation, responded, "What we're doing is we're buying really important portfolios that we think are worth a lot more, and we're trading out of ones that are worth less." Callan said that Lehman was quickly deleveraging its own balance sheet. She also said, "There are assets on the books that we have a high degree of confidence are undervalued." She spent the next 10 minutes telling Kramer about the firm's residential real estate assets in California and Florida, two of the hardest-hit markets, suggesting she expected them to rebound soon. Having come to the conclusion that any alliance with Kramer could only be problematic, Fuld quickly changed the subject and began pumping Kramer for information. "So, what are you hearing out there? Who's coming after us?" Fuld said that he had become convinced that two of the nation's most powerful financiers, Stephen A. Cohen at SAC Capital Advisors in Greenwich, Connecticut, and Kenneth C. Griffin of Citadel Investment Group in Chicago, were largely responsible for both the short raid and rumor-mongering, though he didn't say their names aloud. "They are liars," Fuld said adamantly of the shorts. "I think it's pretty safe for you to go out and say they're liars." Kramer, while sympathetic, made it clear that he wasn't prepared to go out on a limb and back Lehman's stock unless he had more information. "I can say that people could be skeptical of the rumors," he offered, and then added, "Why don't you go to government? If you think this is so bad, and you think that there's a real bear raid and people are lying about it, why don't you go tell the SEC?" But Fuld, growing increasingly agitated, only repeated, "Why don't you just give me the names of people telling you negative things about us?" Kramer was flushed. "Look, there isn't anybody. I do my own work. And my own work makes me feel that you're taking down a lot of crap, and you're not selling a lot of crap, and that therefore you really need cash." Fuld didn't like being challenged. "I can just categorically dismiss that. We've been completely transparent. We don't need cash. We have tons of cash. Our balance sheet has never been this good," he asserted. But Kramer was still skeptical. "If that's the case, why aren't you finding some way to be able to translate that cash into a higher stock price, buying some of your bonds?" Fuld scoffed as he brought the meeting to an end. "I'm on the board of the Federal Reserve of New York," Fuld told Kramer. "Why would I be lying to you? They see everything." It was mid-May, and David Einhorn had a speech to write. Einhorn, a hedge fund manager controlling over $6 billion of assets, was preparing to speak at the Ira W. Zohn Investment Research Conference, where each year 1,000 or so people pay as much as $3,250 each to hear prominent investors tout or thrash stocks. The attendees get to absorb a few usually well-thought-out investment ideas while knowing that their entrance fee is going to a good cause, the Tomorrow's Children Fund, a cancer charity. Einhorn, a 39-year-old who looked at least a decade younger, was sitting in his office a block from Grand Central Terminal, pondering what he would say. With only 7 analysts and a handful of support staff, his firm, Greenlight Capital, was as peacefully quiet as a relaxation spa. No one was barking trade orders into a telephone. No one was high-fiving a colleague. Greenlight was known for its patient, cerebral approach to investing. "We start by asking why a security is likely to be misvalued in the market," Einhorn once said. "Once we have a theory, we analyze the security to determine if it is, in fact, cheap or overvalued. In order to invest, we need to understand why the opportunity exists and believe we have a sizable analytical edge over the person on the other side of the trade." Unlike most funds, Greenlight did not use leverage or borrowed money to boost its bets. Einhorn's analysts spent their days studying 10-Ks in conference areas with wonky names like the non-recurring room, a reference to the accounting term for any gain or loss not likely to occur again, a categorization sometimes used by companies to beef up their statements. For Einhorn, it was a red flag, and one that he used to spot businesses he could short. Among the companies he had identified from recent research was Lehman Brothers, which he thought might be an ideal topic for his speech. While questioning Lehman's solidity may have become the most popular recent topic of Wall Street gossip, Einhorn had been quietly worried about the firm since the previous summer. On Thursday, August 9, 2007, 7 months before Bear went down, Einhorn had rolled out of bed in Rye, New York, a few hours before dawn to read reports and write emails. The headlines that day struck him as very odd. All that summer, the implosion in subprime mortgages had been reverberating through the credit markets, and 2 Bear Stearns hedge funds that had large positions of mortgage-backed securities had already collapsed. Now, BNP Paribas, the major French bank, had announced that it was stopping investors from withdrawing their money from 3 money market funds. Like Bernanke, he had canceled his weekend plans to try to better understand what was really happening. "These people are workers in France. They've got a money market account that they're earning no money on. Their only goal is to have that money available to them whenever they want it. That's what a money market account is. You can't freeze the money market," he told his team. Einhorn called in the 7 analysts who worked for him to assign a special project. "We're going to do something we don't usually do research-wise," he announced. "Instead of the usual painstaking investigation into a company or a particular idea, they were going to conduct, on both Saturday and Sunday, a crash investigation of financial companies that had subprime exposure." He knew that this was where the problem had started, but what concerned him now was trying to understand where it might end. Any banks that held investments with falling real estate values, which had likely been packaged up neatly as part of securitized products that he suspected some firms didn't even realize they owned, could be in danger. The project was codenamed the Credit Basket. By Sunday night, his team had come up with a list of 25 companies for Greenlight to short, including Lehman Brothers, a firm that he had actually already taken a very small short position in just a week earlier, on a hunch that its stock, then at $64.80 a share, was too high. Over the next several weeks, names were removed from the credit basket as Greenlight closed out some short positions and focused its capital on a handful of firms, Lehman still among them. As these banks began reporting their quarterly results in September, Einhorn paid close attention and became especially concerned by some of the things he heard in Lehman's September 18th conference call on its third quarter earnings. For one, like others on Wall Street at the time, the Lehman executive on the call, Chris O'Meara, the chief financial officer, seemed overly optimistic. "It is early, and we don't give guidance on future periods, but as I mentioned, I think the worst of this credit correction is behind us," O'Meara announced to the analysts. More important, Einhorn thought Lehman was not being forthcoming about a dubious accounting maneuver that had enabled it to record revenue when the value of its own debt fell, arguing that theoretically it could buy that debt back at a lower price and pocket the difference. Other Wall Street firms had also adopted the practice, but Lehman seemed cagier about it than the others, unwilling to put a precise number on the gain. "This is crazy accounting. I don't know why they put it in," Einhorn told his staff. "It means that the day before you go bankrupt is the most profitable day in the history of your company, because you'll say all the debt was worthless. You get to call it revenue, and literally they pay bonuses off this, which drives me nuts." 6 months later, Einhorn had listened intently to Lehman's earnings call on March 18, 2008, and was baffled to hear Aaron Cowan offering an equally confident prognosis. It was, in fact, the emergence of Cowan as Lehman's chief defender that had galvanized his thinking. How could a tax lawyer, who had not worked in the finance department and who had been chief financial officer for only 6 months, understand these complicated assessments? On what basis could she be so certain that they were valuing the firm's assets properly? He had suspected that Cowan might be in over her head, or the firm was exaggerating its figures, ever since he had had the opportunity to speak directly to her and some of her colleagues back in November 2007. He had arranged a call to Lehman to get a better handle on the company's numbers, and like many firms do as a service to big investors, it made some of its top people available. But something about the call unnerved him. He had repeatedly asked how often the firm marked or revalued certain illiquid assets, like real estate. As a concept, mark-to-market is simple to understand, but it is a burden to deal with on a daily basis. In the past, most banks had rarely, if ever, bothered putting a dollar amount on illiquid investments, such as real estate or mortgages, that they planned to keep. Most banks valued their illiquid investments simply at the price they paid for them, rather than venture to estimate what they might be worth on any given day. If they later sold them for more than they paid for them, they made a profit. If they sold them for less, they recorded a loss. But in 2007, that straightforward equation changed when a new accounting rule, FAS 157, was enacted. Now, if a bank owned an illiquid asset, the property on which its headquarters was located, for example, it had to account for that asset in the same way as it would a stock. If the market went up for those assets in general, it would have to record that new value in its books and write it up, as the traders put it. And if it fell, in that case, it was supposed to write it down. Of course, no one ever wanted to write down the value of his assets. While it may have been an interesting theoretical exercise, the gains and losses are not actually realized until the asset is sold. Mark-to-market had a practical impact. A firm that had a huge write-down had less value. What Einhorn now wanted to know was whether Lehman reassessed that value every day, every week, or every quarter. To him, it was a crucial question, because as values of virtually all assets continued to fall, he wanted to understand how vigilant the firm was being in reflecting those declines on its balance sheet. O'Meara suggested the firm mark the assets daily, but when the controller was brought onto the call, he indicated that the firm marked those assets on only a quarterly basis. Cowan had been on the phone for the entire conversation and must have heard the contradictory answers, but never stepped in to acknowledge the inconsistency. Einhorn himself didn't remark on the discrepancy, but he counted it as one more point against the firm. By late April, he had already begun speaking his mind publicly about the problems he saw at Lehman, suggesting during a presentation to investors that, from a balance sheet and business mix perspective, Lehman is not that materially different from Bear Stearns. That comment had gone largely unnoticed in the market, but it did raise the ire of Lehman, and led to an hour-long phone call between Einhorn and Cowan as she again tried to answer his questions to his satisfaction, and to seek to turn his view of the company around. But despite her outward affability, he felt she was obfuscating. Now, as he began preparing for his major upcoming speech in late May 2008, it was that conversation with Callan that made him think he needed to make Lehman the focus of his presentation. He decided to reach out to Callan one last time, sending her an email to inform her that he planned to cite their earlier conversation in his talk at the Ira W. Son Investment Research Conference. She responded immediately, skipping the niceties. "I can only feel that you set me up, and you will now cherry-pick what you like out of the conversation to suit your thesis," she wrote back. Einhorn was accustomed to companies turning hostile. Anyone who wanted to be loved in the financial industry had no business selling shares short. He fired a tough email right back. "I completely reject the notion that I have been disingenuous with you in any way. You had no reason to expect that our discussion was confidential in any way." And then he finished writing his speech. Einhorn stood in the wings of the Frederick P. Rose Hall in the Time Warner Center on May 21st, waiting for his turn to speak. He had been scheduled to take the stage at 4:05 p.m., just after the markets closed, timing that had been carefully planned by the organizers of the conference. Given his stature within the industry and what he was about to say, and considering the firepower of the investors in the audience, he could easily rattle the markets, especially Lehman's shares. As investor events go, and there are many, this was one that genuinely mattered. The hedge fund industry is famously reclusive, but today the key players in the field were in attendance, the auditorium packed with industry titans such as Carl Icahn, Bill Miller, and Bill Ackman. By some estimates, the guests in the audience that day had more than $500 billion under management. From the stage's corner, Einhorn watched as his warm-up act, Richard S. Pazina, a successful value investor, was apparently finishing his speech, having run over his time allotment as he offered his big investment idea to the audience. "Buy stock in Citigroup," he instructed, suggesting that at $21.06 a share, its closing price that afternoon, it was a screaming buy. "This is classic value. There is lots of stress," he said. "When we come out of this, the upside is huge." If an investor had actually heeded that advice, he would have lost an enormous amount of money, but the audience applauded politely as it waited for the main event. Beyond speaking about Lehman, Einhorn viewed his appearance today as an opportunity to promote his new book, Fooling Some of the People All of the Time, which stemmed from an earlier speech he had delivered at this very conference in 2002. A speech that had landed him in trouble with the feds. In it, he had raised questions about the accounting methods used by a company called Allied Capital, a Washington-based private equity firm that specialized in mid-sized companies. On the day after he criticized the firm, shares of Allied plunged nearly 11%, and Einhorn, at age 33, immediately became an investing hero and a villain to those he bet against. After that talk, which happened to be the first public address he'd ever given, he had actually expected regulators to look into his accusations of fraud at Allied. Instead, the Securities and Exchange Commission started investigating him and whether he was trying to manipulate the market with his comments. For its part, Allied fought back. A private investigator working for the company obtained Einhorn's phone records through a frowned-upon and potentially illegal approach known as pretexting. That is, pretending to be someone else in order to obtain privileged information about another person. Einhorn's battle with Allied had been going on for 6 years, but today, patient as ever, he would use his bully pulpit to take on a much larger opponent. Einhorn finally placed his notes on the podium. As he surveyed the crowd, he noticed the glow of dozens of BlackBerries in the first few rows alone. Investors were taking notes and shooting them back to their offices as quickly as possible. The markets may have been closed for the day, but in the trading business, a valuable piece of information was worth its weight in gold, no matter what the time. There was always a way to make money somewhere. Einhorn opened his remarks in his slightly nasal Midwestern monotone by recounting the entire Allied story and tying that back to Lehman Brothers. "One of the key issues I raised about Allied 6 years ago was its improper use of fair value accounting, as it had been unwilling to take write-downs on investments that failed in the last recession, he told the audience. That issue has returned on a much larger scale in the current credit crisis. What he was saying was that Lehman hadn't owned up to its losses last quarter, and the losses this time were bound to be much bigger. After laying out his provocative thesis, Einhorn related an anecdote. Recently, we had the CEO of a financial institution in our office. His firm held some mortgage bonds on its books at cost. The CEO gave me the usual story. The bonds are still rated AAA. They don't believe that they will have any permanent loss, and there is no liquid market to value these bonds. I responded, "Liar, liar, pants on fire," and proceeded to say that there was a liquid market for these bonds, and they were probably worth 60-70% of face value at the time, and that only time will tell whether there will be a permanent loss. He surprised me by saying that I was right. He observed that if he said otherwise, the accountants would make them write the bonds down. From there, Einhorn segued back to Lehman Brothers and made it clear that he felt the evidence suggested the firm was inflating the value of its real estate assets, that it was unwilling to recognize the true extent of its losses for fear of sending its stock plummeting. He recounted how he had listened intently to Callan's performance during her by now famous earnings call the day after the Bear Stearns fire sale. On the conference call that day, Lehman CFO Aaron Callan used the word great 14 times, challenging 6 times, strong 24 times, and tough once. She used the word incredibly 8 times, he noted. I would use incredible in a different way to describe the report. After that rhetorical flourish, he recounted how he had decided to call her. With a projection screen displaying the relevant figures behind him, he told how he had questioned Callan about the fact that Lehman had taken only a $200 million write-down on $6.5 billion worth of the especially toxic asset known as collateralized debt obligations in the first quarter, even though the pool of CDOs included $1.6 billion of instruments that were below investment grade. "Miss Callan said she understood my point and would have to get back to me," Einhorn relayed. In a follow-up email, Miss Callan declined to provide an explanation for the modest write-down, and instead stated that, based on current price action, Lehman would expect to recognize further losses in the second quarter. Why wasn't there a bigger markdown in the first quarter? Einhorn explained that he had also been troubled by a discrepancy of $1.1 billion in how Lehman accounted for its so-called Level 3 assets, assets for which there are no markets, and whose value is traced only by a firm's internal models. Between its earnings conference call and its quarterly filing with the SEC several weeks later. I asked Lehman, "My point-blank question is, did you write up the Level 3 assets by over $1 billion sometime between the press release and the filing of the 10-Q? They responded, "No, absolutely not." However, they could not provide another plausible explanation. Clearing his throat audibly, Einhorn ended his speech with a warning. "My hope is that Mr. Cox and Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Paulson will pay heed to the risks to the financial system that Lehman is creating, and that they will guide Lehman toward a recapitalization and recognition of its losses, hopefully before federal taxpayer assistance is required. For the last several weeks, Lehman has been complaining about short sellers. Academic research and our experience indicate that when management teams do that, it is a sign that management is attempting to distract investors from serious problems." Within minutes of Einhorn's leaving the stage, news of his speech had been broadcast throughout financial circles. Lehman was in for some serious pain when the market opened the following day. The shares would fall as much as 5%. As Einhorn headed up Broadway to attend a book party being thrown for him at the restaurant Shun Li West, he leafed through the program of the conference he had just left and saw something that made him smile ruefully. Lehman Brothers had been one of the patron sponsors of the conference, having paid $25,000 so that the world could hear him publicly undermine the firm's credibility. Chapter 6.
Who talked?
Dick Fuld demanded, scarcely able to control his fury, and looking as if he might leap across the table and strangle someone. Lehman's executive committee, the firm's top managers, were arrayed around a conference room table on Wednesday, June 4th, awkwardly sitting in absolute silence. Fuld held a copy of that day's Wall Street Journal in his hand. There, on page C1, was what he described to them as the greatest betrayal of my career. He had practically choked that morning when he read the headline, Lehman is seeking overseas capital, with its subhead adding the damning detail. As its stock declines, Wall Street firm expands search for cash, Maytap Korea. There it was, the morning's news, the secret plan he had been working on for the past month to counter the critics and demonstrate strength, exposed for the entire world to read. He had been working frantically to shore up the firm, and now, he thought, the leak put all that effort in jeopardy. Fuld had spoken to the reporter Suzanne Craig on and off the record many times over the last few months, but he'd certainly never breathed a word of this. Craig's article was brief and to the point. She knew that Lehman had been in discussions with the Korea Development Bank, a state-owned policy bank in South Korea. She knew that it would be a huge international deal, and that it was being orchestrated by Kunho Cho, Lehman's top executive in Seoul. The only way she could have learned those essential details was if someone in the know, someone at the table in the conference room that morning, in fact, had leaked the story. Coming on the heels of David Einhorn's campaign against the firm, Lehman's stock had fallen 22.6% since his speech in May. It was yet another public relations disaster. Fuld knew perfectly well that bankers were occasionally prone to being loose-lipped about their clients. But this concerned the firm he had given his entire life to, and was about its very survival. The breach of loyalty stung him deeply. Just a day earlier, rumors had circulated that Lehman was so desperate for liquidity that it had tapped the Federal Reserve's discount window. That was untrue, but Lehman's stock was pummeled anyway, falling 15%. For the past 2 weeks, Fuld had been forced to respond to such rumors on an almost daily basis, as Einhorn's comments had taken on enough credibility to sow seeds of doubt about Lehman's own. To Fuld's thinking, that was precisely Einhorn's objective. Fuld's co-chief administrative officer, Scott Friedheim, had been in touch with nearly half the public relations flacks in the city, desperately attempting to formulate a counterattack against Einhorn and the shorts. How does this guy have any credibility coming after us? Friedheim asked Joel Frank and Steve Frankel, two crisis specialists. We can't go tit for tat with everyone who makes a claim, he'd said to another PR executive, Stephen Lippin. In the meantime, the firm had established a clear script for all discussions with the media. There would be no more winging it. They couldn't afford any mistakes. Fuld thought Craig's coverage had crossed the line, even if it was a legitimate scoop. To him, in his fit of rage, it was as if she had knowingly set out to undermine the firm, just like Einhorn. The article made Lehman seem like a collection of petty high school cliques, a gossip mill. He had always considered her one of only a handful of trustworthy reporters. The week before, she'd even asked to sit in on one of Lehman's management meetings, a request he thought was ludicrous. But he'd declined the request politely. I'd like to be helpful, he explained, but I can't allow that. When Craig phoned Fuld that afternoon to follow up on her story, he lit into her mercilessly. You pose as a responsible journalist, but you're just like the rest of them, he said. Your seat at the table has been removed, he shouted, then slammed down the receiver. There would be a new rule in effect at Lehman, he subsequently decreed. Nobody, not even the PR department, was allowed to speak to the Wall Street Journal ever again. When he learned of Fuld's diktat, Andrew Gowers, Lehman's head of communications, was beside himself. I don't understand how on earth this policy is supposed to help us communicate in the middle of all this if we're going to shut out the biggest financial paper in the country, he complained to Friedheim. I don't know, Friedheim replied with a shrug. It's between Dick and the paper. Scott Friedheim knew who the leaker was, or so he believed. At 42 years old, Friedheim was the youngest member of Fold's inner circle. The son of the former CEO of Chiquita, he was the ideal Fold operative, a get-it-done loyalist with a killer instinct. As the firm's co-chief administrative officer, he wasn't so much a banker as he was a highly paid strategist. To Fold's detractors, he was one of the chairman's pets, a know-nothing protector of the throne who shielded Fold from any number of ugly truths. Friedheim was an executive in the Joe Gregory mold. He owned an enormous home in Greenwich and a constantly rotating fleet of cars. He had recently bought the mobile office once owned by one of his friends, hedge fund mogul Eddie Lampert, a black GMC Denali outfitted with internet access that he had chauffeur him to Manhattan each day. "Isn't this awesome?" he once announced excitedly when he showed off the vehicle to colleagues as it blasted the theme song to Mission Impossible. After the tense meeting with Fold about the journal story, Friedheim was determined to find the leaker for his boss. He had, in fact, sensed that something was amiss the night before, after he'd had a flurry of confusing phone calls with Craig and with Lehman's spokesperson, Kerry Cohen. He had been frustrated because he couldn't get a straight answer about the coming story. Early the next morning, Erin Callan had dropped by his office, which she rarely did, and innocently asked about the story. "Do you think it will make the stock go up?" With that, it became clear to Friedheim that the leak had been her idea. Like a growing group of executives up and down the organization, Friedheim had come to the conclusion that Callan was in the wrong job, and he had grown tired of her perky self-assurance. She performed for the media as though she were on some kind of reality show. She might have pulled off the earnings call back in March, but now he questioned Gregory's decision to put her in the job, referring to her as a diversity hire. He couldn't believe she had gone off and talked to Einhorn before his speech without first consulting anyone. He'd been trying to put that fire out for a week now. And he had been furious back in April when Craig, in another journal story, had crowned her Lehman's straight shooter, as if the rest of them were a pack of untrustworthy liars. Callan just didn't know where the line was drawn. She kept a model of a private jet on her desk and revealed details about her personal shopper to the press, blithely unaware of the resentment it inspired. The worst was when she framed a photograph of herself getting out of a limousine from a gushy profile in the Condé Nast Portfolio magazine that pronounced her the most powerful woman on Wall Street, and hung it on her office wall. Gregory had had to tell her to take it down. Friedheim, now on the warpath, called security and ordered the company's phone records searched. He soon discovered what he regarded as all the proof he needed. Callan had indeed spoken to Craig the day before. Whether that meant she had actually informed the reporter about the Korea trip was yet to be determined. But the phone record gave him an excuse to talk to Fold about her. When Friedheim arrived at Fold's office, he found Gregory there and proceeded to present his findings to both men. He concluded by saying that he wanted to approach Callan about the call himself and added, "We can't rule out firing her." Gregory, her mentor, was aghast at the accusation. Nobody was getting fired, and as far as he was concerned, nobody was even going to mention the matter to Callan. "She has too much on her plate," Gregory insisted, and Fold nodded his agreement. He simply could not afford to lose his CFO, not in the current climate, and not even if she had done the unthinkable and leaked the information. In his heart, Fold knew that his Korea gambit was a Hail Mary pass. Lehman's own banking operation in Seoul was effectively a mirage. It had never produced any business significant enough even to warrant Fold's attention. He had also been warned repeatedly by just about everyone in the office that there were some serious doubts about the players involved. The whole success of the effort hinged on two individuals. Kun Ho, a well-connected banker with impeccable manners who, as far as anybody could tell, was simply unable to close any deal. And Min Il-sung, a former Lehman Brothers banker based in South Korea, who had left the firm and had managed to snag a prestigious new appointment as the head of the Korea Development Bank. While Fold had always liked Min, years earlier when Min was working for Woori Financial Group, he had brought Lehman in on a joint $8.4 billion purchase of a troubled loan portfolio Some of Men's other colleagues at Lehman were stunned by the appointment, as were a number of KDB's staff who, having judged his credentials as inadequate, had tried unsuccessfully to stop it. Min, however, was undeterred. He had grandiose visions. At a dinner with his new colleagues, he sang a song called Leopard in Mount Kilimanjaro as an expression of his desire to be a powerful force in the world of finance. The Lehman situation presented the first major opportunity to achieve that goal. Before he had even formally started his job, Min had approached his friend Kung Ho about doing a deal. Kung Ho had, in turn, brought Jesse Batal, the debonair head of Lehman's Asian-Pacific operations based in Tokyo, into the talks, and the idea started to gain momentum. What choice did Fold have but to play this situation out? In less than a week, on June 9th, the firm would be announcing its first quarterly loss, a staggering $2.8 billion, since American Express spun it off. The stock was already down 18% in 3 days. Fold had to find capital, and at this point, he would try any avenue he could. He had been pressing his old friend Hank Greenberg, the former chairman of AIG, to put money into the company, as well as trying to get an investment from General Electric, but he couldn't be certain that either would come through. Certainly, Fold did have some reason to believe that a constructive agreement might be negotiated with the Koreans. The Monday before the Lehman team had left for Asia, David Goldfarb, Fold's chief strategy officer, had raised his boss's expectations. "Korea's situation sounds promising," Goldfarb wrote in an email that he also sent to Gregory. "They really are looking to restructure and open up financial services, and seems to want Anchor Event to initiate the effort, which could be us. I still prefer a Hank Greenberg or GE solution, but if that is not there, we could make this strategically based as well." Between Kung Ho and ES's, Min's, relationship, it feels this could become real. "If we did raise $5 billion, I like the idea of aggressively going into the market and spending two of the five in buying back lots of stock and hurting Einhorn bad. Lots to do on this. Been speaking to Jesse and Kung Ho. Sounds like the Koreans are serious on this and are looking to do something aggressive. Could be interesting timing for them, to get some attention away from faster growth Asian economies. Could be interesting, but as we know, these things often don't go further than the rhetoric." On June 1st, a small team of Lehman bankers had headed to New Jersey's Teterboro Airport and set off for Korea in the firm's Gulfstream. The senior person aboard, Tom Russo, Lehman's chief legal officer, had little deal-making experience, but as one of Fold's confidants, he could serve as a trusted pair of eyes and ears. Mark Shafir, the firm's head of global mergers and acquisitions, and the brother of Robert Shafir, whom Gregory had unceremoniously forced to quit, was the lead deal banker, along with Brad Whitman, a talented acquisitions expert who had spent most of his career merging the nation's far-flung telecommunications firms into a handful of powerful players. Completing the group were Larry Wiesenick, the firm's head of global finance, and lawyer Jay Clayton of Sullivan & Cromwell. They would meet Kung Ho and Batal when they got there. With a stop for refueling in Anchorage, the jet made the trip in 19 hours, and on arrival, the exhausted Lehman contingent took a fleet of cars to their hotel on the outskirts of Seoul. The Shilla was a peculiar place with a lobby that looked like a spaceship, but at least it had a bar. The first meeting in Seoul involved only lower-level officials of KDB and Hana Financial, which was also considering an investment. Shafir and Whitman could tell immediately that this was not a deal that was likely to happen. Neither Korean firm had brought along lawyers or hired its own U.S. advisors, and Min, who had not yet officially started as chief executive of KDB, could not even take part in the talks. "This is bullshit," Wiesenick exclaimed after the initial session ended, having served little purpose other than to make introductions. Even as the talks progressed, the Lehman team could hardly tell to whom they were speaking. At one point, Russo engaged in what he thought was a productive exchange with an individual who turned out to be an outside accountant. "Relying on Kung Ho is like bottom of the ninth, two outs in the World Series," Shafir complained to his American colleagues the first night in the bar. "And you send up a guy to the plate who hasn't gotten a hit all year." Lehman had wanted to start discussions at $40 a share, but by the end of the first day, the stock was at $30. Nobody, not even this group of deal-hungry Koreans, was going to pay a 33% premium. The whole affair became increasingly unreal. No food was served at the meetings, so the Lehman bankers were starving by the time they got back to their hotel, where the meals were generally dreadful. The only palatable item they could find on the menu was tuna, which most of them ate every day of their stay. But neither the subpar accommodations nor the Koreans' erratic behavior could dent Russo's enthusiasm. He was going to make this happen. "They're going to do this deal," he told his colleagues, supported by Kunho and Batal. "They're going to put in $10 billion. They're going to make their balance sheet available for loans." No, they weren't, thought Shafir. They weren't going to do anything of the kind. Sitting on a hotel room bed crowded around the speakerphone, the group called full back in New York, with Russo leading the conversation. "Dick, I'm feeling very good about it," Russo enthused. "I think we have a 70% chance of getting something done with these guys." Full's delight at the news, however, was short-lived. The group returned to New York empty-handed on June 5th. Efforts to come up with even a rudimentary term sheet had completely failed. The Koreans had obviously been deterred by Lehman's cratering stock, and simply may not have had the wherewithal to bring about such a major piece of business. Even Russo had lost confidence. "We're not going to get a deal with these yo-yos," he told Fuld. Moments after hearing the news, Fuld, frustrated as ever, screamed down the hall at Stephen Birkenfeld, a member of the firm's executive committee. "Were you the one who said you can't trust the Koreans?" he asked. "I don't think I phrased it that way," Birkenfeld said. "Yes, you did," Fuld said. "And you were right." The Korean deal wouldn't go away quietly, though. A few days later, men called Fuld and insisted he still wanted to get something done. Fuld figured the only way it was remotely possible was if the Koreans hired a real advisor. So he called up Joseph Perella, the mergers and acquisitions guru who had recently started a new firm, Perella Weinberg Partners. "Listen, I've got something for you," Fuld told Perella. "You're going to get a call from ES. Do you know him? He used to work for me." Fuld was explicit about what he needed out of the deal. "We're trading at about $25. Our book value is $32. We need a premium. So we'd take $35 to $40. Perella, who assigned the project to his colleague, Gary Barancik, didn't think the odds were good. KDB was a national institution with what seemed to him to be a local charter. They had no business branching out with a risky international deal. "It's like the Long Island Energy Utility trying to buy something in Russia," he told Barancik. But they promised to do the best they could. Skip McGee, a 48-year-old Texan, commuted to New York every week from Houston to run Lehman's investment banking operations. He'd board a private plane using the firm's NetJets account every Sunday evening around 7:30, land in New York around midnight, and take a car to his rental on the Upper West Side. Come Thursday night, he'd be on a first-class flight back to Houston on Continental. McGee, a classic old-school back-slapping banker, was clearly ambitious. After graduating summa cum laude from Princeton and getting a law degree, he had spent nearly two decades at Lehman, first as a banker for wildcatters in the oil patch of his backyard, and then moving up the ranks until he became the head of the entire investment banking division and joined Fuld's vaunted executive committee. For some time, McGee and his team had been having deep misgivings about the way the firm was being managed. His unit, which advised corporate clients on mergers and stock offerings, had its best year ever in 2007, bringing in $3.9 billion in revenue. And yet the firm's stock, which was used to pay a large portion of everyone's bonuses, was being decimated by anxiety about what was happening on the other side of the house, namely the firm's investments in real estate assets. Even worse, the constant rumors and headlines about Lehman's health were beginning to affect his team's ability to sign up new clients, who were reasonably worried about hiring them. It had gotten so bad that some clients had asked to include a key man provision in their engagement letters, that would guarantee that the banker assigned to them would continue working with them if Lehman was sold or went bankrupt. McGee had expressed his anxiety to Fuld a month earlier when he asked to be given control over the firm's capital-raising efforts, which up until that point were being overseen primarily by management on the 31st floor, who he felt were not professional deal-makers.
"You have an investment banking division that does this for a living," McGee told Fuld. "This is crazy. I should leave if you don't trust the investment bank to do this." Fuld agreed, and McGee's troops, Shafir and Whitman, had been included in the Korean junket. But since that conversation, the firm's situation had only worsened. They all knew that the announcement of the next big quarterly loss was only going to exacerbate the situation. Resentment was boiling up through the ranks, and it was no longer directed exclusively at Aaron Callan, who, the bankers had concluded, was merely a symptom of a bigger problem. The person they had now come to believe was responsible for many of Lehman's troubles, the risky bets on corporate real estate, the constant reshuffling of executives into jobs they were ill-equipped to handle, was Joe Gregory, the firm's president and Fuld's closest associate. McGee and Gregory had never gotten along very well to begin with. Each was too headstrong for the other. And in recent months, Gregory had been discussing ways to push McGee aside by assigning him to a new commodity trading business back in Houston, the prospect of which left McGee lukewarm. The Sunday before pre-announcing the earnings report, June 8th, as everyone worked over the numbers on the 31st floor, McGee, in a golf shirt and khakis, slipped into Fuld's office to review the investment bank's earnings and projections. But just as McGee had finished his summary and was getting ready to leave, he said, "When we get through this, we need to have a serious conversation." "About what?" Fuld asked. "About a change in senior management," McGee blurted out.
"What?"
Fuld said, distracted now from the numbers before him.
"Well, I guess we're having that conversation now, then," McGee said, getting up to shut the door. Gregory's office was just a few feet away. When he took his seat again, he told Fuld precisely what he had meant.
"You need to move on Joe."
Fuld was dumbstruck. "Joe Gregory is off the table," he said, raising his voice. "He's been my partner for 25 years. It's not fair. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror."
"Whether it is fair or not, you need to do something about Joe," McGee replied.
"You've not been served well by your COO. He's in over his head. He's not minding the store. He's made some horrible personnel decisions. And he's not watching your back on risk." Reminding McGee that, as a member of the executive committee, he was responsible for making key decisions along with everyone else, Fuld said, "The entire executive committee is the risk committee." McGee, realizing that he was not getting his point across, stated carefully, "You're a wonderful leader. But when the books are written, your Achilles heel will be that you have a blind spot for weak people who are sycophants." Fuld barely heard the last part of McGee's comment, as he had been thinking about Gregory. "I'm not doing it," he finally said, ending the discussion. McGee left the office, fairly certain that Gregory's job was safer than his own. After McGee departed, Fuld sat in his office, stunned. He couldn't conceive of the firm without Gregory. But nothing that was happening was making any sense. The firm he had rebuilt with his own two hands was falling apart everywhere he looked. Over at Neuberger Berman, Lehman's asset management arm, executives were in open revolt, trying to disentangle themselves from the mess at headquarters. Lehman had bought Neuberger in 2003, and as long as times were good, it had been a useful, relatively trouble-free contributor to the firm's bottom line. But when Lehman's stock started its swan dive, Neuberger employees panicked. They had become accustomed to the steady income generated by managing rich people's money, but that was now in jeopardy, as a good portion of their bonuses were paid in stock. A week earlier, on June 3rd, Judith Vail, who ran a $15 billion small-cap fund for Neuberger, fired off an email to the Lehman Executive Committee, with the exception of Fuld, demanding that top Lehman managers forego bonuses and make preparations to spin off Neuberger. Morale at NB is at a dangerously low level, largely because Lehman stock is a significant portion of our compensation, and as such, our comp is not tied to anything within our control, Vail wrote. Many believe that a substantial portion of the problems at Lehman are structural rather than merely cyclical in nature. The old Neuberger franchise, which resides at 605 Third, is largely intact. However, this is a people business, and the continuing health of the franchise is dependent on retaining key producers and support personnel. Don't slam bonuses of key producers and support personnel at NB because of management mistakes made elsewhere. George H. Walker IV, the head of Lehman's investment management division and a cousin of President Bush, immediately sought to blunt Vail's criticism. "Sorry, team," Walker wrote in an email to everyone who'd received Vail's missive. "The compensation issue she raises is a particular issue for a small handful of people at Neuberger, and hardly worth the EC's, executive committee, time now. I'm embarrassed, and I apologize." The correspondence was forwarded to Fuld, who wrote in reply, "Don't worry. They are only people who think about their own pockets." Did anyone in the firm still have any loyalty? Although Joe Gregory's title was still Chief Operations Officer, in the opinion of many Lehman executives, he had spun off into the ether years earlier. Few seemed to flaunt their personal wealth as much as he did. The helicopter commute was just the start of it. He and his wife, Nikki, bought a house in Bridgehampton for some $19 million, and even though it was completely decorated, they had it redone top to bottom with their own designer. He drove a Bentley and encouraged his wife to take shopping trips to Los Angeles via a private plane. But despite an extravagant lifestyle that was estimated to cost in excess of $15 million a year, he kept most of his net worth tied up in Lehman stock. To gain access to cash, he had pledged 751,000 Lehman shares in a margin account as of January 2008, which, based on where the shares were trading, would have allowed him to borrow roughly $40 million. It wasn't Gregory's spending habits that people inside Lehman found objectionable, though. He had a lot of money, and he obviously wasn't the only one who liked to throw it around. What did seem somewhat odd was his portfolio of responsibilities. Even in his prime, Gregory had never brought in big deals or made many hugely successful trades himself. His job was to be Fuld's unquestioning confidant, and as long as he was that, everything else was up to him. He loved being the in-house philosopher king, an evangelist on the subject of workplace diversity, and a devotee of the theories described in Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, Blink. He gave out copies of the book and had even hired the author to lecture employees on trusting their instincts when making difficult decisions. In an industry based on analyzing raw data, Gregory was defiantly a gut man. He was also an advocate of the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which used Jungian psychological principles to identify people as having one of 16 distinct personality types. A typical question was, do you prefer to focus on the outer world or on your own inner world? Gregory used Myers-Briggs results to help make personnel decisions. It was his conviction that individual expertise was overrated. If you had smart, talented people, you could plug them into any role, as sheer native talent and brains trumped experience. Gregory seemed to revel in moving people around, playing chess with their careers. His greatest experiment to date had been naming Aaron Callan to be the chief financial officer. He and Callan eventually became so inseparable in the office that many were convinced, though it was never substantiated, that the two were linked romantically. Around the time she was promoted to CFO, Callan separated from her husband, Michael Thompson, a former Lehman vice president who'd left the firm. Gregory loved being a mentor to younger executives like Callan, and he was fully cognizant of his role in Fuld's hierarchy. If there was a difficult conversation to have, he considered it his responsibility to handle it. In this regard, Gregory and Fuld were total opposites. While Fuld had a gruff, tough guy exterior, he had soft spots. He could be quite sentimental and tended to struggle when faced with difficult decisions, especially those concerning personnel.
Gregory, in contrast, was much more gregarious, a leader given to championing underlings and setting lofty goals for the firm. He gave generously to charities, especially those involving breast cancer, which Nikki had survived. And he had spent a full year working to establish a mentoring program between Lehman and historically black Spelman College of Atlanta.